Good to see you tonight. We do have several visitors with us, I know. We're delighted to have you with us. Some are here for the very first time, and we're especially glad that you are with us. This morning, we did a little bit of a character study of the Apostle John and looked at how his relationship with Jesus changed his life. I want to talk with you tonight a little more about the Apostle John. We've talked in our auditorium class about the fact that John in his gospel does not refer to himself by name, but he refers to himself in a somewhat oblique way, subtly referring to himself in a way that I believe the original readers would readily have understood. And one of the ways in which John speaks of himself is as the disciple whom Jesus loved. The disciple whom Jesus loved. You know, there were several people that Jesus was especially close with. I think sometimes we don't appreciate that fact the way that we should. Every human being has certain ones that he is especially close to in a very emotional way. And that was certainly true with Jesus. In fact, even in the Gospel of John, we learn that Jesus was especially close with Mary and Martha and their brother Lazarus. In fact, the Gospel of John says that Jesus loved all three of them. He was also very close with three of his 12 apostles, Peter, James, and John. They were something of an inner circle, and Jesus is so often in the company of those three apostles. A lot of the things that Jesus did, a lot of the things that happened to him, happened in the presence of those three apostles, and maybe not the other apostles. And yet of those three apostles, there was one that Jesus was closer to on a personal level than any other. And it wasn't the Apostle Peter. Sometimes people might think that it must have been Peter. He kind of seems to be something of a leading figure among the apostles. But it wasn't Peter. As close as he was with Peter, Jesus was even closer with the Apostle John. And in fact, John indicates this several times in his gospel by referring to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. There are a lot of people that have a problem with John referring to himself in that way. We've talked in our auditorium class about liberal skeptics who don't want to accept the testimony of the gospel, don't want to accept it as authentic history, and one argument that they use, in fact, I'll just tell you one of the major arguments that they use to try to say that the Apostle John couldn't be the author of this gospel is no one would refer to himself as the apostle whom Jesus loved, as if somehow Jesus loved John in some special way that was different from the others. Well, the fact of the matter is, Jesus did love John in a special way, and that's not to say that he didn't love the other apostles. In fact, John emphasizes in John chapter 13, the first few verses, that Jesus loved all of his disciples. He loved them so very, very much. In fact, willing to even give himself up for them. But Jesus did have a specially close relationship with John, and that's not unusual when you think about that. And John was not engaging in some kind of self-aggrandizement when he talked about himself being the disciple whom Jesus loved. He was simply pointing out that that relationship that he had with Jesus was one that was extremely close, so close, in fact, that Jesus, even when he was on the cross, looked at John and looked at his mother Mary, and emphasized to John that woman, my mother, she's your mother. And saying to Mary, this man, he's your son. In other words, Jesus was saying that the relationship that he had with him was akin to a fleshly brother. And John recognized that, and he took Mary into his own household from that point on. The reason why John emphasizes this about himself, I'm convinced, is not because he's trying to brag that he was in some specially close relationship with Jesus. It wasn't that he had some ego issue. It was because he was testifying about the things that Jesus did, and he was offering formal testimony as an eyewitness. And that's what the Gospel of John is. It's this eyewitness account. And ancient historiographers understood what I hope modern historiographers understand, that if you really want to have the best insight into someone and the best insight into what happened, you need to talk with people who were there. You need to talk with eyewitnesses. And certainly in the ancient world, historiographers understood that the best eyewitnesses were the ones who were closest to an individual. John is the best eyewitness possible because of his close personal relationship with Jesus. And as a result of that, there were things that John witnessed that even some of the other apostles didn't witness. They were all eyewitnesses of Jesus and his ministry, but some of the apostles witnessed things the other apostles did not. The three, Peter, James, and John, as I said a moment ago, witnessed things that the other apostles didn't witness because they weren't there at the time. But of those inner three, that inner circle, John was the one who was closest to Jesus of all of them, and there were occasions when John was there and the other apostles weren't. Or there were occasions where John was close to Jesus, right there in proximity with him, and able to have private conversations with Jesus that the others didn't. And John is emphasizing that he was this especially close disciple of Jesus because he wants to emphasize his own credentials as a witness of Jesus and what he taught, what he said, what he thought, what he did. John could be the best witness possible. I want to talk with you tonight about some things that John witnessed that the other apostles didn't witness, at least not to the same extent that John did. I want to just talk with you about three. There are other things that we could talk about here. In fact, I really think that most of the things in the Gospel of John, I think the point of the Gospel of John in comparison with the Synoptics is that John is purposely trying to give testimony that he had special insight about. And so I think a lot of the discourses that John records in his Gospel, probably like the discourse with between Jesus and Nicodemus and some of the other discourses, John, because of his closeness with Jesus, he was there, and maybe some of the other apostles weren't. So I think that John's gospel as a whole is, for the most part, trying to supplement the information in the synoptic gospels with some things that John had personal eyewitness ability to testify about. And so there are things that John witnessed the others did not. I'm going to talk to you, though, tonight about three things that John was aware of because he was right there, things that the other apostles did not have firsthand knowledge of. Do you realize that Jesus' prediction, specifically that Judas was the one who would betray him, that was something that Jesus disclosed to John in a specific way that the other apostles, at least at the time, were not aware of? Oh, they were informed by Jesus about someone among them betraying Jesus. They just didn't know who. But John knew ahead of time because Jesus told them. Look over, if you will, at John chapter 13, beginning with verse 21. This is John's account of the Last Supper when Jesus is there with his 12 apostles. And the text says in verse 21, when Jesus had said this, he became troubled in spirit and testified and said, "Truly, truly, I say to you that one of you will betray me." The disciples began looking at one another at a loss to know which one of them he was speaking. There was reclining on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Simon Peter gestured to him and said to him, "Tell us who it is of whom he's speaking." He, leaning back thus on Jesus' bosom, said to him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus then answered, "That is the one for whom I shall dip the morsel and give it to him." So, when he had dipped the morsel, he took and gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. After the morsel, Satan then entered into him. Therefore, Jesus said to Judas, "What you do, do quickly." Now, no one of those reclining at the table knew for what purpose he had said this to him. For some were supposing, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus was saying to him, "Buy the things we have need of for the feast," or else that he should give something to the poor. So after receiving the morsel, Judas went out immediately, and it was night. Do you appreciate what's going on here, this setting? The text talks about the disciples of Jesus, the 12 apostles with Jesus, reclining at the table. And they didn't sit on chairs at a table like we do in our culture. But in that culture, you would recline and lean on your left elbow and then use your right hand to eat. And so the person who was reclining just to your right, his head would be at your chest level. And so when the text talks about one of the disciples, the one whom Jesus loved, leaning upon Jesus' breast, that's just an idiomatic way of talking about he's the one who's just to the right of Jesus, and therefore his face is right there in closest proximity to Jesus. And so Jesus had made this astounding statement to the 12, and he was obviously troubled by all of this. He was emotionally disturbed by the thought of the fact that one of you is going to betray me. And he said so, and everyone heard. But Peter, while all of them are talking among themselves, and who's he talking about? What's he mean by all that? Peter signals to John, whether he mouths to him or whether he, you know, and gives him a hand signal, you know, who's he talking about? Ask him. And so John, probably in something of a whisper, whispers to Jesus, "Who is it?" And Jesus says, "The one whom I give the morsel to." And of course, even that is an outlandish statement about Judas's betrayal, because the whole concept here of this Passover meal, Jesus is the host. Jesus is the one providing the meal for all of them. And even as Jesus himself recognized, there is tragic irony that one who eats at my table is the one who will betray me. But Jesus specifically said to John, when John asked him, "Who is it?" Jesus said, "It's the one whom I'm about to give a morsel to as host, as a sign that he's enjoying my hospitality, eating at my table." And Jesus at that moment dipped the morsel in the sop and gave it to Judas to eat. And John understood what he meant. John understood who he meant. And at that moment, Judas decided, "Now's the time for me to go and betray the Lord." And Jesus said to Judas, and everybody, including John, heard it. Jesus said, "Judas, what you do, do quickly." And the others didn't understand what that meant, what Jesus meant. I think the point John is making is, he understood. He's shocked by it. He doesn't know what to make of it. But he knows something that they don't even appreciate. That the one among them who was going to betray them was Judas Iscariot. And I think the whole point of all this, folks, that we need to appreciate, and what John is emphasizing as he recounts this testimony, he's emphasizing that Jesus always knew ahead of time what Judas was going to do. This wasn't something that was perpetrated upon Jesus against his will or against the will of God. In fact, if you go back to John chapter 13 and verse 1, look at how John, as he testifies about this, introduces the entire Last Supper, the entire occasion. He says, verse 1, "Now before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come that he would depart out of this world to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, got up from supper and laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, he girded himself and he washed his disciples' feet. And that's how he began this entire meal. As their host, stooping down and performing a servant's task, washing their feet, and now inviting them to partake of his table. And it was in the aftermath of all that that Jesus became so emotional about the fact that one of them, one of these men who were so close to him, one of them would actually be his own betrayer. And John wants us to know because of his first-hand eyewitness testimony that Jesus told him ahead of time that Judas was going to be the one to do it. Not just leaving it in general terms that one of the 12 would, though that in and of itself would have been a tremendous prediction, but Jesus even knew the particular individual who would be the traitor. And Jesus still extended him the same courtesy and the same love. And John wants all of us to understand Jesus knew ahead of time everything that was going to happen. You see the point John is trying to make here, folks? This wasn't some tragic accident that happened to Jesus. This wasn't some horrible event that was perpetrated upon Jesus against his will. This wasn't something that overturned the plan of God. No, far from it. God knew always what was going to happen because all of this was part of God's plan. Jesus knew what was going to happen because this was all part of God's plan. And Jesus even knew which one of them it was going to be. He wasn't caught off guard with this at all. Jesus always intended to fulfill God's plan to give himself up as a sacrifice for the sins of the world. John says, I know that's a fact because he told me that ahead of time. What else did John know from firsthand experience that the others did not know? Well, John knew the events of Jesus' trial. You see, when Jesus was arrested, the disciples in general just fled. One of them, Peter, followed afar off, the synoptic gospels tell us. But John here says, not that he stood up for Jesus, but he did follow and he was there. At least that seems to be how we're expected to understand what is said here in John chapter 18, verses 15 and following. Again, as I've said, John tends to refer to himself rather obliquely, and I think that is what he's doing here when he speaks about himself, not by name, but as the other disciple who was there with Peter. John 18, beginning with verse 15, says, Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now, that other disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing outside at the door, so the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. And then he begins to report on the slave girl questioning Peter, who was the most prominent of the apostles. Weren't you with Jesus? Didn't we see you with him? And of course, Peter begins his threefold denial of his master. And then what you see in verses 19 and following, John, there in the courtyard, or there in the area of the house of Annas. In fact, John is the only one of the Gospels that refers to this first interrogation, this first part of the trial, being before Annas, who was the former high priest. It was his son-in-law Caiaphas who was the official high priest, but Annas was the older, more experienced, and that one that so many still viewed as sort of the unofficial high priest of the nation. Jesus, John testifies, was first brought to him. And John was there. And John was probably there in the background, in the shadows, but he was there and he heard what was going on. He saw what was going on. It was John then who could report as an eyewitness how Annas questioned Jesus in verse 19 about his disciples and about his teaching. And John reports this, that Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said." When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me?" So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest, for the more official trial, if you can call any of this kind of nighttime secretive trial an official trial. John was there. And John saw that. And John was there and understood that Jesus didn't cower. He didn't shrink in fear. He didn't beg for mercy. Nor did he rant and rave like someone who was falsely accused, trying desperately to save his life. No, Jesus stood there in absolute confidence and control, like he always did, as someone who was exactly in the spot that he expected to be, that he intended to be, that he needed to be. He was the center of a mockery of a trial, a sham of a trial, and he was going to be falsely accused of being a blasphemer, and he knew the whole time that's exactly what was going to happen. Because he was there, ultimately, to offer himself up as a sacrifice for every one of these people who were mistreating him and every other person throughout the world, throughout time. John says, "I was there. I saw him. This is the one who is the king of the world. And here's how he conducted himself in that very hour." What else did John witness that the others did not? It's very clear that John witnessed the crucifixion. The other apostles weren't there. They'd fled, fearing their lives. Peter had denied the Lord three times, and then when the Lord turned and looked at him and the cock crowed, Peter went out weeping, ashamed of himself. But John, at least, was there at the cross, and he saw what happened to Jesus. In John chapter 19, beginning with verse 25, the text says, "But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene." And then he goes on to say, "When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom Jesus loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, 'Woman, behold your son.' Then he said to the disciple, 'Behold your mother.' From that hour, the disciple took her into his own household." What we see then is that John was there. And even when you're reading in the Synoptic Gospels the accounts of what happened at the cross, again, it was John of all the apostles who could testify, even to the other apostles, here's what happened, here's what they did to our Lord and Master. Here's what happened when they crucified him. John was there, and he saw how they crucified Jesus between those two criminals, as if Jesus himself was a malefactor. John saw, and he talks about how they put this inscription over his cross, written by Pilate, the king of the Jews. In fact, John, of all of the gospel authors, he's the one who says that they wrote that out, king of the Jews, in three languages. Again, it's those kind of details that an eyewitness is going to recall and testify about. John says in three languages, so everybody would know, they put the king of the Jews up there. And of course, Pilate meant that as a mockery, as a ludicrous kind of statement, that this man claimed to be the king of the Jews. And he knew it irritated the Jews to have that up there, as if Jesus really was the king of the Jews. John's the one who saw that, though, and John's the one who recognized, I'm sure, the irony in that. Because they all meant it as a mockery, but Jesus really was the king of the Jews. They just weren't realizing it. And even there in his suffering, with nails through his body, attached to a piece of wood, he was doing exactly what the king of the Jews and the king of the world needed to do, because that's what his people needed. John saw that. John saw how the soldiers stripped him of his garments and then in utter disrespect of this man, divided up his garments, tore his robe along the seams and divided up his garments among them. And then the tunic that was seamless, they cast lots to see who would get that. After all, this is what you do when a person is dead. I mean, you know, what does he leave behind? Well, here, the clothes off his back. And of course, the tragedy in all this is he isn't even dead yet. But they strip him of his garments. He's as good as dead as far as they're concerned. And they steal his clothes and they gamble for his tunic. And John sees all of that. Sees all of that disrespect. John is the one who hears Jesus say, I'm thirsty, just before he died. You know, when a person is getting closer and closer to the moment of death, as the body shuts down, the throat is parched, it's that thirst that's a sign that one's about to die. Here, this man tortured to death is now asking for someone to at least give him a little bit of water. And John is the one who heard that. John is the one who saw how there was a jar of sour wine there, and they put a sponge, touched that sponge full of sour wine to his mouth. And John is the one who then testifies in verse 30, therefore, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And that's when he died. And John saw that. And John was there when the soldiers came a little bit later, after Pilate had told them to hurry up, because the Jews wanted the body and wanted to hurry up before the sun set. So John saw, as verse 32 and following says, the soldiers come and break the legs of the criminals on either side of Jesus, and then coming to Jesus, they didn't break his legs. John noted how that was interesting, because Jesus had said he was going to die, and John, as he writes this, understands why he had to die. He had to die because he was the Passover lamb. He was the sacrificial lamb. And what is it every Jew understood about the Passover lamb? It had to be a perfect sacrifice. You don't break the bones. That's why they roasted it over a fire, the law said. Don't break the bones. Put it in a pot. No. It has to be perfect. And John noticed. Isn't that amazing, John thought. They were going to break his bones, but he's already dead. He'd already accomplished his purpose. He'd already finished everything he needed to do as a perfect sacrifice. He was the perfect sacrifice down to the very end. And John was there and he saw that. And he saw the soldiers take a spear and thrust it up into the side of Jesus just to verify that he was dead. And John saw blood and water pour out of the wound, showing he definitely was dead. And verse 35, John says this, "And he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth, so that you also may believe." You know, when John wrote this gospel, there was a false teaching that was beginning to arise among some quarters of Christianity. It was those quarters where Christianity had come in contact with Greek philosophy, and there was a Greek philosophy of, it was based upon Neoplatonism, but it was ultimately what would become part of Gnosticism in the second century. But it was a view that was called Docetism. And basically the Docetic view was, it was sort of a perverted form of Christianity saying that, well, yeah, Jesus was an emanation of God, but it isn't that God really took on human form. Jesus wasn't a real human being. That's what these Greek philosophers who adopted some of Christianity's teachings, that's what they said. That's how they twisted it and perverted it. And John is writing here in this gospel, and certainly in his epistles, it's very clear that he is refuting that docetic view that just said, well, Jesus seemed to be a real human being. He appeared to be a flesh and blood human being, but he really wasn't. He was just some kind of an apparition or something. And John testifies, and John says, I was there, and I'm the closest one to him, and I had a relationship with him. He was a real flesh and blood human being. And he loved me, and I loved him, and I was there, and I was there when he died. And that was no apparition, that was no ghost, that was no phantom. That was a real flesh and blood human being. And when they thrust that spear up into his gut, out flowed bloody water, signifying that he was dead, signifying this was a real human being. John says, I know because I was there. And I can't help but think, as John reflected back upon all of this in the years that followed, and reflected back upon when he was there, when that blood and water flowed out of Jesus' side, I can't help but think John didn't think about the times when Jesus said, my blood is true drink. My blood is what's going to quench your spiritual thirst. I can't help but think that John wouldn't have thought about, as that blood and water came out of Jesus' side, or at least years later as he reflected back on that, I can't help but think John wouldn't have thought about the occasion when Jesus had one time said that out of his belly would flow life-giving water that would quench the thirst and cleanse everyone. He was talking about the Spirit, but he used the figure of water that would be life-giving drink. His blood that would be life-giving drink. And I think that's part of why John records those discourses of Jesus about the living water and about how he said his flesh is true food, his blood is true drink. John wants now those of us who are hearing his testimony to get all of this, to understand all of this symbolism, to appreciate Jesus and who he was. And John says, I was there. And he who's testifying to you, John says, is one who knows he's telling the truth so that you can believe, so you can have faith. Folks, we have a hard time sometimes in our day believing that Jesus was a real human being, too. Oh, we're not like the Docetics of the late first and second century. We know Jesus became a human being. We know that intellectually. But I wonder if there's not a certain kind of, I don't know, neo-docetism, if you want to use a term, that we kind of have. Because I think a lot of people, they just don't appreciate how real Jesus was. They don't realize that what we're talking about here, this was God who became a real human being. That's not a folk tale. And that's not that he somehow became some apparition of a human being. He was a real human being. And it's not that, well, he was a human being in the fact that, well, he had flesh and bone. But he wasn't really like us. He wasn't a real human being. Not really. He didn't feel what we feel. He didn't have the emotions that we feel. He didn't go through the kind of things that we go through. He wasn't really like us. And John says to us, don't you dare think that. He absolutely was a flesh and blood human being just like us. And he had all the emotions and all the feelings that we have. And he understood what pain and suffering was just like we do, if not more. And John says he absolutely knew what human relationships were because he loved me. And I was closer to him than anybody else was. And I loved him. And that's who we're talking about. That's who the King is. And he's the one who died for all of us. And John says, I want you to believe it because it's true. And John says, as he concludes his gospel, he says, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written. These have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name. Folks, when you go out this week into the real world and face what the real world has to confront you with, you understand that Jesus is real and that he really became a human being just like us, and he really did go through all of this, and he really did all these miracles, and he really did rise from the dead, and he really did suffer on that cross for all of us and shed his blood for real. And he did that to save all of us so that we could have life in his name. And you believe that because John is affirming to you, I am telling you the truth. I was there. Do you believe that? Do you believe him? I do. I think he's the best possible witness there is. I don't think he's lying. I think he's telling the sober truth. And I'm willing to then base my life on the truthfulness of what he's testifying. And Jesus wants us all to do that. Are you willing to do that? John hopes that you will. And Jesus hopes that you will. Is there someone tonight who needs to become a disciple of Jesus? Won't you listen to what John is testifying to you and obey Jesus even tonight while together we stand and sing this song of encouragement?